Ladies and gentlemen, who are we kidding? Gentlemen, welcome to episode 4 of Open Season. This is Ashley Vance, and I'm joined, as usual, by my partners in crime, Alfresco's Matt Acey, and Mule Source's Dave Rosenberg. We've got a special treat lined up for you today. We have the Ubuntu Canonical Chief, Mark Shuttleworth, here to tell us what's going on with the Ubuntu tribe, and we will no doubt be having a little look at Microsoft, Oracle, Red Hat, and all the other companies that Canonical competes with or partners with. And with that, welcome to the show, boys.
Pleasure as always.
It's nice to actually have some new blood around here. We needed a new prima donna.
Yeah, arguably you're the biggest prima donna, actually, Mark. I don't know if you've heard that we were accused of Matt was actually the one who caused it all, of being a big prima donna.
I hadn't caught up on that, no, but I'm happy to step up and start and vent if that's you know, appropriate for the venue.
So Mark, thanks for making the time for us. I thought we kind of kick off. It's probably of little interest to other people, but I've had a long running battle to get my Dell Ubuntu laptop, and last week I reached victory point when it arrived in the mail. I was just curious if you've actually used their model, because the mouse is hypersensitive. It's like I'm having a seizure sometimes when I go across a web page with a lot of links on it. They all just fire up.
That's really interesting. I haven't used the laptop, and Walt Mossberg said exactly the same thing. So it must be a general configuration issue with the specific driver that they're using on the touchpad there.
Yeah, I saw his review, and then I went in and fiddled with the mouse stuff, but in the end, it's still pretty sensitive. But overall, it's really fantastic. I loaded up the graphics, the beta graphics stuff. What's that called again? With the jelly windows and...
The comp is the 3D desktop stuff.
Yeah, and, you know, frankly, I mean, that pretty much brings it up to Visto or Mac OS X, kind
of
like...
Yeah, it gives it a whole extra sort of dimension. I really hope that the free software community realizes the opportunity that we have to kind of set the pace in terms of the R&D that's being done with how you actually turn those fancy effects into something that really make people more productive as opposed to just feeling kind of slick and cool. I think it's a huge opportunity. We, you know, for the first time, we're pretty much at the cutting edge on desktop stuff.
Go ahead, Matt.
I was just going to ask a question on that, Mark. I have a question as to how you guys got involved with Dell, but I want to come back to that one. Keep going down this road. How likely do you think it is that the open source community will build a good desktop? I mean, I have full faith that a company like Canonical can say, can go out and develop a good desktop, as I think Novell has done and Red Hat has done, but to a lesser extent. But are geeks the right ones to be building a good desktop? And I ask that, I actually don't know the answer to that.
It's really interesting. Obviously, we hope so, because that's the line of work that we're in. I think we have to take a slightly nuanced view on this. A desktop is made up of a whole bunch of components, and the motivations of the people behind each of those components can vary wildly. I do think we're starting to learn that there are some things that companies do really, really well if they have a business rationale for investing in something, and there are other things that the community does really, really well. And I do think that what we're missing at the moment is a really powerful and compelling corporate reason to invest in desktop technology. I think when you have that, when you have a sort of a corporate reason to lead, then having a community process around that really fleshes the thing out and gives you something that feels very rounded and very polished and very kind of comprehensive in a way that a proprietary product just never does. But if you don't have that central engine for investment, then what you end up with is something that looks like lots of bits of brilliant ideas that are sort of glued together, which is a reasonable way of describing where we are now with the Linux desktop.
But how does that affect, for example, if we say that the desktop is pretty, you know, I'm an Ubuntu guy as well. I run it on a ThinkPad, although I'm back on a Mac. how does that affect the applications, right? So if the desktop gets to a point where we feel it's pretty good, or in fact it's usable, but OpenOffice still kind of sucks, how does that affect the overall picture, do you think?
Then that is a weak story. My sense is that we're gearing up for another round of innovation in the things that have been traditional desktop applications. And that's partly driven by what's happening on the web, where we're seeing a whole slew of attempts being made to migrate desktop apps to the web. So things like spreadsheets and word processing and presentations and so on becoming kind of web apps in a very real sense. I'm not sure that pendulum is going to swing and stick completely on the web front, though. But what I think this is a catalyst for people to reinvest in those kinds of applications. And free software and Linux seems like a very good place to start that process. So we're not doing that at the moment. Canonical isn't investing very heavily in word processors and spreadsheets and so on. We may need to do that. It may be that that's something that we have to do to really sort of inject some energy into it. But my sense is that other people are gearing up to make those kinds of investments pretty soon, driven by the idea of moving some of the stuff to the level of web services.
You think that what Sunil put more backing into the OpenOffice project, or that's kind of the direction it'll go, or it'll come from somewhere else?
OpenOffice is a bit of a tragedy at the moment, and it's a sticking point not only for Sun, but also for, you know, IBM, Novell, Canonical, Red Hat, everybody who lives and breathes by the free software environment. I think the biggest problem in OpenOffice at the moment is the interaction between the sort of corporate folks and the community folks. And I think there's a desire to get it right, but it isn't right at the moment. And so OpenOffice hasn't been through that kind of purge and reform process that Mozilla went through when it moved from being Netscape to ultimately being Firefox. Mm-hmm. There was a sort of reinvention process that happened there that isn't happening in OpenOffice.
What's the main problem? Sun just has different ambitions than kind of where the community wants to go?
No, I don't think it's as simple as that. I think it has to do with the sort of details and practicalities of who's responsible for what. My sense is that Sun is really keen to solve this problem now. They realize that it's as much a problem for them as it is for everybody else who's depending on OpenOffice. And my sense is really that they do want to solve it. They had an OpenOffice conference earlier this month in Barcelona where a lot of these issues were raised, and there have been some encouraging news with IBM and Sun apparently getting over some of their differences to the point where they can actually collaborate, which is really important. So hopefully that will re-energize it. If not, then I would hope groups like the KDE office and the GNOME office guys will start to close the gap, and perhaps we would consider shifting away from OpenOffice as the default office environment in something like Ubuntu.
So, I mean, from my perspective, it seems like for OpenOffice to have a chance, it needs to be freed from IBM, it needs to be freed from Sun, it needs to be freed from any one corporate entity. I personally think the Eclipse model would fit perfectly for what it needs, because I don't think, my sense is, and I'm not a developer, but my sense is that developers don't care all that much about an Office suite other than finding something as an alternative to Microsoft. But most developers don't spend a lot of time creating presentations, they don't spend a lot of time in spreadsheets, etc. And so I personally, and I may be wrong here, and I'd be interested in your feedback, but I personally don't believe that it's the community, the developers out there scratching their own itches that are going to come up with a great Office suite, but rather it's going to be a community of self-interested commercial capitalist pigs that, a la Eclipse, that will develop a great Office suite competitor to Microsoft Office. That's my sense.
I think I would agree with you. I think what the community tends to contribute is mostly in the realm of extensions and integration things and plugins. If you look at Firefox, for example, there's a hard core of contributors who do most of the heavy lifting to make the platform effectively. And then there's this phenomenal fringe community of add-ons and extension developers. And Firefox has really cleverly made that line very explicit so that you don't have to be a core Firefox contributor to get a feature that you're interested in tested and, you know, have people experience that that kind of that idea. You just write a Firefox extension to do that. And so I think I agree with you that OpenOffice, in its ideal, most successful incarnation, will probably have most of the core engineering done by IBM and Sun and perhaps Canonical, Red Hat, Novell, and others. But they definitely need to have a rich community around that in order to make it a sort of a more robust, more comprehensive offering than you would get just from those corporate guys with their top-down agendas.
What about, for example, the Novell stuff? Like, Novell made all the Excel macros work, and they never really donated it back to the project. What do you think the point of that is?
Yeah, I don't really want to get into the intercompany politics because we end up having relationships with all of the different players. Everyone knows that relationship, the Novell-Sun relationship around OpenOffice, is not a happy one at the moment. And I think there are attempts being made, good faith attempts on both sides, to kind of build bridges between that. And I hope that at this stage everybody is kind of getting past the idea that if you have your own fork of a project, then that's a good thing and a good way to differentiate yourself. Novell may be in a bit of a sticky situation because of their deal with Microsoft, right? They're supposed to be working on things to make OpenOffice more compatible with the future Microsoft Office products, and I don't know how they plan to contribute that or whether there are issues or blockers for them in contributing that. I suspect they wouldn't have got themselves into a situation where they can't, but it may be a complicating factor for them. Anyway, I think we all want, and all the developers certainly want, this stuff to get ironed out. It's very hard to become an OpenOffice contributor. It takes like 8 or 9 hours to build OpenOffice. So to work up a patch and then see whether or not your patch actually makes, you know, any difference just requires an enormous commitment to becoming a developer. And that's silly. If you look at what happened with Firefox, you know, the original Netscape code base was the same as that. It was very complicated to build, very, very monolithic. And by opening it up to the community, one of the main things they got was cleaning it up, streamlining it, simplifying it, carving out the relevant pieces. And then Firefox kind of emerged like a bullet from that. And OpenOffice needs to go through the same process. If we don't see signs of that happening in the next couple of months, I think, then we'll really be looking elsewhere for a healthy community to drive Office on the free software desktop.
Do you think it's easier then to hack Linux, for example, to get involved in Ubuntu as a project? Or, for example, you know, I just saw that Red Hat delayed their desktop yet again. Is that easier than something like OpenOffice at this point?
It's a lot easier to hack on the kernel because... Yeah. It has a very well-defined, well-documented build system. It doesn't take a huge amount of time to build just the core kernel and the modules that you're hacking on. The modular interfaces are well-defined so you can work on your driver and the module effectively and not worry too much about the internals of the kernel. It's, you know, when you have a lot of open source developers participating in a project, they tend to fix build problems very quickly. And the fact that the build system is one of the most intractable areas of conflict in the OpenOffice project is a sign to me that things are not healthy, because it's one of the first things that would get cleaned up if they really were open to contribution. Anyway, I say all of this not as criticism, because in conversations with both Sun and Novell, I have the sense that they really are working to address the issues that are there. Certainly Sun has said that they really want to get this sorted out now. So we have to trust that they will do so.
Now, maybe Ashley and Mark, I'm not sure if you've listened to the podcast before. You can go ahead and admit that you listen to it over and over. You have it set on auto-repeat. But we try to pull out mechanics from this, and you actually have just identified one open-source mechanic that we should call out, and that is that if you want your open source project to succeed, and I think this is frankly one of the reasons that Ubuntu has succeeded, and Linux more generally has succeeded, is you absolutely have to have modularity, because you have to, it's got to be something that somebody, a developer with X amount of free time or X amount of not so free time that they want to contribute to your project, they've got to be able to come in and essentially do drive-by development. There has to be good documentation. They have to be able to work on some piece of the project without having to completely build the entire project from scratch. As just an example of this, and you know, maybe a self-interested example, but Alfresco, my own company,
the greatest company in the land.
No, but I mean, when we started, we had very little outside contribution, and it was kind of for the Firefox reason. It was A, the documentation was crap. B, you know, it was kind of monolithic, and for you to get involved, you had to be part of the in club and whatnot. And we've since gone to an architecture where we have what are called AMPs, Alfresco Modular Packages, I think is what it translates to, such that it's kind of like building a plugin for Mozilla or for Firefox. It's that easy to do, and it's something distinct that you can just plug in. And as a result, all of a sudden, our outside contributions have exploded. And it's not because the project is any better or worse, it's because we've just made it easier to contribute. And that, for anybody that is starting an open source project or an open source company funded project, you have to have that modularity or else you're just never going to get any outside contribution.
We actually took that to the next step with the Forge, where on the Mule Forge, which we launched, you can do builds and everything else off of it. So you never actually have to put anything into place. All you have to do is put your code up there, and it'll run the builds for you. And it's helped tremendously. Matt's exactly right.
Yeah, I would extend the idea from the modularity of the code base to also the processes that you have to support people coming in and publishing stuff. You know, I don't think you have to become a Firefox developer to publish a Firefox extension. You just, you know, there's a process that doesn't require anybody asking permission or any social network or social relationships or, you know, form filling to become a participant in that little economy. And I'm guessing that your AMPs are, you know, where you see a lot of the contributions are in things that are kind of integration-oriented. So connecting Alfresco to some or other piece of infrastructure, which, you know, may be on a long list of things that you'd like to get to, but is sort of mission-critical for that particular person. And so they get there long before you do. And this is what you really get from having kind of community, being open to community participation.
Mark, how big is the development sort of community outside of Canonical itself that contribute to Ubuntu?
I think we're up to just over 100 people who have direct commit access. I like to think of it in terms of sort of concentric rings, effectively. They're the core guys who can literally change anything. And they are, I think, 50-50 now, Canonical and non-Canonical. And then there's another crowd around that takes it up to, I think, a couple of hundred. And then if you go all the way out to documentation and translations and things, it goes up into the tens of thousands.
Right.
From a developer perspective, Debian is very much sort of an engine room of development for us, and I think that's as it should be. Right? I think one of the things open source projects do really well is separate out the engineering R&D, which should really happen on the tip, effectively, from the productization. If you look at the Linux kernel, that's beautifully done, right? Linus does a phenomenal job of leading the team of people who care about the tip of development. And they expressly don't care about the, what I would call the productization, although they have a good relationship with the productization guys so that work ends up getting done in the natural place between those two. And they expressly don't compete with each other. Linus doesn't try and compete with the Red Hat kernel team. He figures out how to get the most out of them. So for us, Debian is kind of like that leading edge tip, and it's where we would like to do as much as possible of the kind of blue sky R&D stuff. And then we just focus on snapshotting, certifying, integrating, and delivering effectively versions of that.
Mark, will you dig into that a little bit more? When we talked last month, you mentioned this, and I think I mostly understood it, but not quite. You just said that you have about 50% of that core development team with full commit rights that actually works for Canonical, which is shocking that you have 50% that don't, because I think if you were to look at, I don't care what project you take, whether it's MySQL or JBoss or you name it, Alfresco, MuleSource, etc., you'll never find anybody with that level of outside commit access. And it means that, I think, it means that you guys are doing community really well, but B, it also means that you must have processes and technology in place to allow you to, when you pull out that certified binary or that certified source code, you can pull it out with confidence. Can you go into that in a little bit more detail as to what Canonical does in certifying its Ubuntu distribution and how you separate? Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, okay, sure. Well, a lot of the work that we do in Ubuntu is still very much sort of forward-looking R&D, so things like the installer, figuring out how new components that are coming down the pike that haven't yet landed in Debian effectively are best integrated into the base system. In my ideal world, you know, our relationship with Debian would be stronger and we would be more confident doing that in Debian, but, you know, for whatever reason, it isn't, and so we still do quite a lot of that work. And then on the productization front, a lot of it has to do with working with the hardware manufacturers and the software manufacturers to make sure that we're aligned as we go through this very tight release cycle, so that as we ship versions of Ubuntu, the hardware guys know that it's going to not only work on their systems but take advantage of, you know, the latest stuff in their systems. That's really important for Intel, for example, or Sun. And the software guys know that it will be compatible with existing stable versions of their products, or versions of their products that are still in development. So we have that kind of focus on reaching out to the broader ecosystem. And as I say, I'd really like to do more of, for us to be doing more of that and less of the blue sky R&D, and for Debian to be doing more of the blue sky R&D stuff. Oh, and for us to be doing the R&D that we want to do more inside Debian. That's just very tricky for us at the moment.
Can I change topic a little bit? I'm sort of curious about some of the relationships that you have with the bigger companies like Dell and whoever else. I guess the one for me that I'm curious about is Oracle, and how come Oracle hasn't either further embraced, or maybe they are, or, you know, what's the relationship like there if they're really trying to make these strange overtones towards Red Hat?
Yeah, that's a really interesting. Oracle's position in the Linux ecosystem is really, really interesting, and a bit it's difficult to understand. Perhaps, you know, I certainly wouldn't claim to understand it. I think we were very, very close to having Oracle certified on Ubuntu. There were a whole bunch of indications that was the case, and then at a very, very high level within Oracle, it was decided that they wanted to have their own Linux offering. And that they should follow the strategy of effectively cloning Red Hat, stripping the trademarks, and then adding some undefined, but probably interesting, level of value. I don't think that the strategy is going to work for Oracle. I think it's interesting and kind of cute. But I think it ultimately puts them in the difficult position of saying to customers, you know, this is a product which is exactly like Red Hat, except that it's better. And that's very hard for ISVs and hardware guys and ultimately customers, to people who really think about it, to accept, right? You're either better, in which case you're different and you can tell me what my, you know, roadmap looks like, or you are the same, in which case I see no real reason to switch.
Did you just did you just call Oracle's position cute?
Yeah, it's an interesting twist on the GPL in the sense that, you know, someone was going to try this. So it's interesting that it was Larry Ellison who made that call, because it's quite a, yeah, it's cute. It's an interesting thing.
I think you're
but
the first person to.
They're going to need to fork or buy Red Hat, one of the two. And so to come back to Oracle and Ubuntu, I think it's very unlikely that they as a company would make a decision to support another version of Linux other than their own when they're trying very hard to get their own one sort of broadly accepted. So I think we just have to sit on the sidelines with Oracle. We have a great relationship with DB2. We have a great relationship with the Postgres community and MySQL. So there are great options for people who want to run databases on Ubuntu. Oracle works perfectly well on Ubuntu. There is a package for it from Oracle, but it's not yet formally certified by Oracle.
I don't think anyone's ever referred to Larry Ellison as cute before.
What do you call Larry
getting,
cute?
He's getting to that kind of quaint old age, isn't he?
So, what about the... Matt, I didn't know if you want to talk more about Oracle, but I was hoping to hear a little bit more about kind of how the Dell deal came around, but feel free to...
No, actually, I was going to ask about that. Earlier on when you were talking about that, the mouse problem, it seems like, it's for outsider looking in, it seems that Dell would have worked closely with Canonical or with the Ubuntu developers to make sure that when it put it out, it was you know, a quality product with all the problems resolved. It sounds like it was more of a arm's distance relationship. Which was it?
The classic model has generally been to take a long time to qualify an OS on hardware, especially something different like Linux. And the downside of that is that you end up shipping a version of the OS that's old. So if you did that, then you'd be saying to people, okay, you can have Edgy on your Dell hardware, rather than saying you can have the latest and greatest. And I think the decision was taken, and I think it's the right decision, that actually it's better to stay close to what's really happening at the desktop. The desktop is moving so fast that having the latest version is actually attractive, even if it does mean that there are likely to be warts and wrinkles for this audience, for this Linux enthusiast audience. They are likely to be the sorts of people who will just reinstall the latest version themselves and then call you up if there's an issue. So it's better just to get them what they're likely to want. And I would credit the Dell guys with moving damn fast on this. I mean, from the time that they did that survey, and the decision was really all driven by their surveys, not driven by us in any way, to when the time that they announced and started shipping the machines was remarkably tight. They really did a very, very efficient job of putting the processes in motion.
I thought that was pretty amazing too. I'm sorry there, Ashley. But you know, it's interesting because we always talk about community and all this other kind of crap and social media and riding the crowd. They actually took what the crowd told them and they did the work, which is pretty impressive for a company of that size.
But at the same time, I got to tell you, I mean, the mouse thing, it is kind of it's infuriating because if you go across something like
mouse on speed,
yeah, if you go across like the Drudge Report or the Register, and you drag your mouse across the page to kind of get to somewhere else, you can fire up like six web pages on the way because it thinks you're kind of clicking every time you know your finger touches this thing. But other than that, I mean, it does. It's actually it's kind of encouraged me to pull Vista off my work desktop because the CPU utilization on my laptop, it never goes above like 15%, and I've got Vista on this screaming fast
machine. No matter
machine.
How much porn you have up in those tabs. Yeah.
Which, and there's
some animated GIFs down like pat.
It is handy for, the mouse is handy for the porn because it, you know, you end up looking at some things that you might not have been into. And,
I would never have clicked on that, honey. It's this mouse.
It opens some new avenues.
It's a big world out there, Ashley. It's a lot out there for you.
But I think, you know, I think it is for Linux enthusiasts, and Dell kind of warns you on your website that, you know, you need to kind of know what you're doing when you go into this. But, I mean, there are all these little details that I think would make... I'm just surprised that Dell kind of pushed that out the door, because I'm sure something can be done in software that solves this pretty easily.
Well, how
definitely. So it's a kind of, I know that this got raised to the point where in 7.10, which is the gutsy Gibbon release, which is kind of going into beta, I think, next week, there is a touchpad sensitivity thing that we added specifically because this issue got raised by, you know, to us from Dell. They wanted some way to do this without having to add some other component to the base of them to install.
What's your prediction on the real, like, you know, when does Ubuntu or when do laptops start running Linux? I mean, is it another year?
We will see a lot more Linux running in consumer electronics devices, so smartphones, handheld. I think it'll move from there to the desktop rather than the other way around. I think developers and so on are going to continue to love Linux. There's nothing coming down the pike from Microsoft that looks to me like it's going to suck the developer community away. Apple is a bit of a threat in that regard, right? A lot of developers love Apple and love the fact that they get a pretty Unix, and a very functional Unix too. But I think this wave of, yeah, consumer electronics is getting so cheap. It's getting so cheap to give you a touch screen, a high-quality touch screen with a pretty impressive CPU and memory and storage behind it. But people are starting to find all sorts of very cool things that they can do with that, from GPSs through their tablets, through VoIP phones, through, you know, there's just going to be a ton of stuff either designed to stick in your home or carry around with you. And I think that's, you know, Linux is going to hugely dominate that.
So I have another
to come from there.
I have another Ubuntu question. I think we lost Matt. We got to get him back on the call here. But I'm wondering about, so for example, I was in Japan a few months ago, and I'm going back and over, and there's actually a ton of like little handhelds that run Linux. How is Ubuntu doing there? Are those sort of are those homegrown off of the kernel kind of thing?
So a lot of the early guys kind of winged it themselves, or they used really specialist providers like MontaVista or Wind River. I think the computing power in those devices is now getting to the point where it's easier for those guys to start looking at running a what, you know, stripped down desktop environment like Ubuntu. Many of the early guys are kind of rolling their own, and Debian is very popular as a starting point. But we've seen since we announced the mobile edition of Ubuntu, which is still you know, a long way from something that I would call a product. I think this first release is going to be, you know, really just foundations more than anything else. We've seen a huge amount of interest from the consumer electronics sector, mainly in Asia, but with the view to a worldwide market, in using that as kind of a standardized base. And I think it'd be great if we could bring Ubuntu-style economics, where you can ship the thing without any royalties for the OS, and you have access to professional service from Canonical. If we can bring that to the consumer electronics industry, then we'll really help the acceleration of Linux adoption in that sector.
Can we just check, Matt, did you get back on?
Yeah, I'm here. I have no idea what happened. But
I'd also like to hear about Juice, if you could talk about that a bit, too.
Juice is very cool, and there was a great article on the concept from Billy Marshall from RPath. I don't know if you guys have had Billy on the show, but he's a really good thinker about how, you know, what's happening at the operating system level. The idea there really is to give ISVs the ability to ship only as much operating system as they need to deliver the functionality that they want to deliver. And that's primarily being driven by the fact that with virtual appliances, virtual machines, ISVs are suddenly actually having to ship the operating system, because until now they really didn't. Like, you would go and buy SAP, but SAP, you know, really wasn't involved in your choice of hardware or software. They would give you a range of options, and they would try to cover all the options that people wanted. But it was kind of your problem to deliver the OS. But if SAP is going to ship you a virtual appliance, then inside that virtual appliance they have to ship the OS. And so for the first time, ISVs are actually thinking about this in terms of, well, who pays for that, and what do I need from an engineering perspective? And so Juice, the idea of having just enough operating system, is very, very cool. And I guess we have a nice starting point in Ubuntu, in that it's very easy for us to strip the image down to the bare essentials that you need for, you know, just to have a booting system. And then any app that comes in on top of that will automatically pull in its dependencies. So it's very easy for people to build these sorts of appliances on top of something like Ubuntu.
But how much of a difference is there really between the Juice image and the standard? Because I was looking at the, I got some megabyte figures from you guys when I did my story, and it didn't seem that dramatic of a difference.
Yeah, in this first edition of Juice, it's like our standard server edition, which is pretty thin, and that's one thing that we do in the server edition that is very popular, is we install just the bare minimum again. But when we know that it's running in a virtual appliance, we can strip down the kernel dramatically, because we don't have to include, you know, literally tens of megabytes of drivers, because we know that VMware or Xen or KVM is only going to expose a certain subset of virtual drive, virtualized sort of hardware things that we need to hook into. And we can also strip some other things down, things like file system utilities and so on, because you will typically you know, you'll pick a file system for your virtual appliance, and you know that the real work is being done on the host somewhere else, and so you, you just want the fastest, simplest file system. You don't want to, you don't want to make any complicated decisions at the file system level. So we can strip the juice image down quite a bit, and for future iterations, we might even go further and strip out things like, you know, documentation and man pages and things like that. As long as we have a very easy way for people to bring those back if they actually want them. Like if you type man foo, it should say, I don't have that, but I can go and get it if you want it. The nice thing about the Ubuntu Juice image is if you type a command that isn't there, it'll tell you exactly what you need to type to bring that command in. So for people developing their images, they can they sit down at a familiar command prompt, and as they're building their appliance, they pull in only the pieces that they need to manage their appliance.
Right. That actually that speaks to the whole modular argument, too, I assume. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, actually, that's very true. It's exactly the same principle.
There's actually a company called FastScale that people might want to check out that's doing kind of their take on thinning out these images. And, I mean, they get versions of Linux down into the kind of tens of megabyte levels. And it's the same kind of idea where they only pull what they need for a given application, whether it's a web server, an app server, and that's it.
Right, and you greatly reduce your attack profile by reducing the amount of code that you're shipping. You reduce the amount of disk space and memory that you need to run the virtual appliances. I do think you can go too far, though. If you're running a super specialized environment that your developers aren't familiar with, you put yourself at some risks of them making mistakes that they just don't know about because they're not familiar with that environment. So, again, I think it's quite nice for guys who are familiar with Ubuntu, who have developers who are familiar with Ubuntu, to be able to build their virtual appliances there because they're going to know how to manage the environment instinctively. They don't have to really come to understand a completely different environment. And similarly for the people then who use those appliances, if they have to get into the level of understanding what's going on in the virtual appliance itself.
Now, what are you making of the virtualization market now? I know you've been, I'm pretty sure you've been a little bit critical of ZenSource in the past, at least. As I understand it, I think we talked, and you just had some struggles working with them. You know, what do you make of the Citrix buy and kind of all the hype around VMware?
So I do think virtualization is kind of a dog's bollocks, right? I mean, it's one of the fundamental changes in how... Geez,
will you translate that, Mark?
Spank me now. No, Matt, I wasn't. That's not for you. I do think that virtualization is one of those big waves that comes through and gives people a reason to rethink big fundamental chunks of their IT infrastructure. And we've only just seen the beginning of it because we haven't yet really seen how it lands on the desktop, right? Well, will you end up actually getting from your bank a little virtual machine which has the browser in it which you use to access your bank site? And do they use that as a way of protecting your online banking experience? It's like one really interesting idea. And so we haven't seen how virtualization will fully play out yet, but I think it's going to touch a whole bunch of different things. But the issues that we had with ZenSource are purely related to the speed at which they were kind of getting their stuff to the point where it is acceptable to the mainline kernel. And, there was a period in time where it just seemed like, other projects that had started later just had done a better job of engaging with the mainland Linux community.
And that's still a problem?
I think that stuff is largely resolved now.
It's resolved, okay. And go ahead, Dave.
Sorry, I had a quick question for you, Mark. At what point do you think that we cross the divide that's holding back the virtual appliances? Because a lot of people use them for evaluation. VMware has all these appliances out there. I don't think many people are using them in production. I talked with Billy Marshall at RPath about this, and he said the same thing, that most people are using virtualization generally, but virtual, like an Alfresco appliance or a MuleSource appliance or a JasperSoft appliance or any of these. These are mostly for evaluation purposes today.
We saw exactly the same thing with virtualization itself. So I think VMware for a long time was really only selling to developers who had to test, you know, would their website look good on 10 different versions of Windows. And hey, VMware is a great solution for that because you fire them all up in a virtual machine and off you go. And you don't have to maintain all of these different machines. And you can reset them, you know, very quickly and easily. So I think that same pattern will be will be displayed in with virtual appliances, that it'll start out with developers using it to prototype and test stuff, and then it'll get to the point where the guy internally is going to say, look, I've done all of this work, we know that it'll work, we can push it to production right now as, you know, a Xen image or a VMware image, or I can package it all up and make it work with, you know, whatever our production OS is on a, you know, on the metal. And that decision is increasingly going to lean towards, you know, just push it out. I suspect that there are the blockers are things like confidence in the management of those virtual machines, and obviously that's where VMware and ZenSource and a bunch of other folks are investing heavily, VirtualIron and others investing heavily to make that possible and to make money doing so, and also in sort of performance issues. It's hard to imagine why you would run a database in a virtual machine at this stage.
So, Mark, it's hard to imagine why you'd run a lot of things in a virtual machine. We work with a company called Cohesive FT, who built basically a chassis to put VMs on top of. And it's an interesting approach, but, you know, if you start to think about, so integration, for example, I mean, you'd have four or five different components that you'd have to get into one VM, and the next thing you know, you've got a pretty honking VM sitting there, and your performance is going to go way down.
Right. The VMware guys, you know, ideally, I think, would like to get to the point where every component is its own VM and they talk to each other using sort of very pluggable, standardized interfaces. And maybe that'll come. It has some nice characteristics. You know, you want to upgrade the VM? Well, fine. You just replace it with a newer version, the whole thing. Boom, done. The downside of that is that the VM can't hold any state. And so it just gets really, really complicated. But think of what Amazon are doing with EC2 and S3. They're effectively forcing people to go through that same process of modularization. Here we are back to modularization and componentization, so that you separate out your state and your logic and things like that. So maybe this is just something that we've got to figure out. Maybe this is what the future looks like.
Mark, I think we'd be remiss if we didn't talk a little bit before our time runs out about kind of the EU rumblings around Microsoft. You know, if they get their way, this would seem to open quite a big business opportunity for you guys.
Well, it is really interesting. I wonder what they're going to get to in terms of remedies, because I mean, we all know that Microsoft is a monopoly, that they fight very hard to maintain that monopoly, and that it's very profitable for them and sort of slows down innovation for everybody else. But what do you do about it? And what do you really, really do about it? It's a very, very hard problem. I'd be very interested to hear what you guys think, what the appropriate remedies would be. I don't think that the old-fashioned kind of sell a version of Windows without the media player thing works, because there's no incentive for them to price it differently, and people will always choose the more fully functional one at the same price. And I also don't think that splitting up the company is really appropriate, because well, the EU can't feasibly do that. So it's a very tough question. Like, how do you solve the problem even once you've recognized in a court of law that there is a problem?
Maybe you could mass mail the continent with Linux on USB drives.
I think that would be great for USB manufacturers.
my sense is that, you know, open source, Ubuntu hasn't been, I mean, it's possible that Ubuntu would be on every shelf in the United States and elsewhere, but for Microsoft's hegemony. But I get the sense that open source is finding its way around Microsoft anyway, and so whatever the remedies may be in Europe, 10 years from now, I think the IT landscape looks a lot different, and Ubuntu arguably plays a big role there. Open source certainly plays a huge role there.
Right.
There's really nothing that Microsoft can do to stop it. It will continue to try to delay as much as it can, and it's it'll continue in some narrow instances to innovate, because it does actually occasionally, very rarely, create new innovative things that people want to buy. Usually it just builds adjacent, moderately interesting things that people have to buy if they want to get value out of this, so they continue the monopoly thing. But open source doesn't seem to be adversely affected in any great degree by Microsoft's monopoly.
Right, the things that open source is really, really good at, Microsoft just happens to be pretty bad at. And so they have found their niches to a certain extent. I do think that some of the remedies that the EU might be considering could make a huge difference. So requiring disclosure of formats and protocols, but in a really effective way, as opposed to the ineffective sort of processes that they've had in place to date. Perhaps requiring access to intellectual property. Those are tough measures to take, but I think they might go a long way towards making sure that projects like Samba and OpenOffice and so on can really deliver genuine alternatives that aren't vulnerable to Microsoft's network effects. I think there are some things that the EU courts could do which would still leave Microsoft intact and you know, able to compete, but certainly level the playing field. It's a really interesting problem.
So I think we've just got about 5 minutes left. So Dave or Matt, if you want to chime in with your money shot question, now is the...
My big question is, besides all the desktop stuff, which obviously you pay attention to, what are the other sort of projects and types of things that you are on your radar?
Well, the thing I'm really personally very interested in is how we collaborate efficiently, right? If Microsoft has their strengths and we have ours, and one of ours is the fact that we have this massively distributed ability to generate innovation, and then we have these really great tools to collaborate between distributed people and bring that innovation sort of into the code effectively. So how do we take that further? How do we improve the flow of collaboration? So that's something that we spend a lot of time working on within Ubuntu, because we're a big complicated project, but also between Ubuntu and projects like Debian and Ubuntu and projects like, you know, the upstream guys. So Launchpad probably reflects a lot of our thinking in that regard. We're trying to figure out how to make that process more efficient. I personally find that just a really, really interesting problem, right? A lot of what's interesting to me about Ubuntu is that it is a softer expression of a general principle, which is shared digital work leveraging the very smartest people, the very most motivated people, wherever they happen to be. Wikipedia is the same. There are similar things popping up around architecture, around engineering, around all sorts of different disciplines, and Ubuntu is just that in software. So how do we make people collaborate really, really efficiently? How do we help them collaborate really, really efficiently? I think that's interesting stuff.
Maddie?
Maddie, that's what my wife calls me, Ashley. You're making me blush.
This is that whole porn thing that Ashley was talking about earlier.
As a man with a woman's name, I have these kind of intuitions.
No.
I'm trying to understand where this prima donna designation comes from, Matt. What have I missed? Because there's people...
No. That was a...
You don't know him well
reader.
Enough. You don't know
is this a soccer thing?
No.
Mark,
if you haven't noticed, I should give a plug to Arsenal. They have not lost a game all season, for those who care, which would be very few people listening to this. But
I saw that there's some well, what about the bloggers who are taking on the billionaire who owns part of Arsenal? I read about that, Matt.
Is that the same guy?
I'm taking him on, too. Taking him on. I don't want him,
Matt,
to.
I think you need to get to know this guy.
I'm trying to get to know other billionaires that can help me out with Arsenal.
Those guys break kneecaps. There's no ways I'm going to go head-to-head with some Uzbek billionaire. I'm sure he's a very nice guy, but his henchmen aren't necessarily the same.
My
henchmen, on the other hand, are wonderful.
Speaking of henchmen and breaking kneecaps, that is actually the question I had. You are far too polite a person to answer this question directly, but I'm going to ask you to do it anyway. Who is your biggest competitor? And basically, I'm trying to goad you into talking about how you interact or compete with Red Hat and how you view Red Hat, Novell, and Sun, and then I guess Microsoft. But I'm guessing that your success will come at the expense of the existing Linux or open source operating system providers, rather than today at Windows' expense. Is that accurate?
So there's definitely, you know, jostling for mindshare and bandwidth between the Linux distros, and that's good. That's healthy. It's competitive. But I think our true long-term competitor is the proprietary internal way of doing things, which is currently best reflected by Microsoft, Oracle, and other companies with whom we would love to partner, like SAP and so on. So that's the interesting thing for us, is that our true competitors, you know, are not so much individual companies as the old way of doing things. The true opportunity for us is to define a better way of doing things that actually sustains itself as efficiently as the old way of doing things did. So this is not so much for me a battle between companies as a battle between ways of organizing talent and ways of paying for talent effectively in the places where you need to pay for it. It's quite possible that Microsoft and their ilk figure out how to play successfully in a much more open fashion than they have in the past. You know, the landscape has changed for them too. And so I wouldn't define it so much as us versus a company as us versus a way of doing things.
Mark, can you give people some kind of idea about, you know, the scope of your business? Can you tell us beyond downloads, kind of customers or something along those lines?
Yeah, I can tell you we do a couple of million a year in revenues, most of that driven by custom engineering, people who want to shape Ubuntu to a particular end quickly, and so see us as the most efficient way of getting that done. It's not anywhere close to what it needs to be to make Canonical sort of an independent entity. Ubuntu, fortunately, you know, I split my funding between Ubuntu and Canonical, and so Ubuntu will continue regardless. So, you know, the amount that it costs to actually produce Ubuntu is small enough that I'm quite happy to underwrite that and commit to underwriting that for a very, very long time, as long as I think it's necessary, which could be decades. Whereas Canonical, I think, you know, needs to find a particular model which fully funds it, you know, in the next 5-10 years, it isn't there yet. But I think, I think it's very, very encouraging what we've achieved within 3.5 years, and I have no doubt that we're on track in that regard.
But essentially, for right now, I mean, your model is a support model similar to Red Hat, isn't it?
It's a services model. Support is one kind of service, but there's lots of other things that you can do with the code base. On the server side, support really is the dominating thing, and we are starting to emerge on the server. There's some really encouraging sort of reports coming in of people finding Ubuntu on the server in, you know, lots of companies all over the world, and that's where it needs to be if we want to make money out of a support business. But there are also other things that we, you know, do as services in terms of custom engineering, particularly in the sort of mobile and consumer electronics area, virtual appliances, and so on.
And then, I mean, Google is this massive user of Ubuntu, and the guys I talk to over there are pretty fanatical about it. But, I mean, is there any significant business relationship with Google?
No, not at this stage. We do get on really, really well. We really like the fact that they have some really smart engineers who are looking at our code all the time and, you know, telling us things that they think would make it better. That works very well for us. But it's not. We don't have the same sort of relationship as they have with sort of Mozilla Corp.
Right. I mean, is that frustrating to some degree? Do they, you know, they're asking for changes? Do they submit a lot of stuff back to you guys that's helpful?
They do submit stuff back to us that's helpful. Obviously, we only put the stuff into the distro that we think is going to be generally valuable. And I think there is something in that, right? If we could figure out how to work with really smart people at companies like Google, because it's not just Google who's using Linux, right? Amazon's using Linux, eBay is using Linux. All of these companies have huge development teams who spend a lot of time building their own systems, but also, you know, tweak Linux to be better for them. We are sort of busily figuring out how to formalize our relationships with companies like that, so that becomes a very efficient flow of patches and information. Just like we're interested in figuring out how we collaborate more efficiently with OpenOffice.org and GNOME and KDE and Linux, you know, the upstream components, it's also really interesting to figure out how you collaborate more efficiently with with the corporates.
Hey, Ashley, one thing. So before we wrap up, yeah. I was talking to someone earlier, and here's an interesting question I think for Mark too, and that is that so Red Hat had a recent reshuffling, and you know we start to see there's a lack of talent right now in the job market. And so one of the things that I think we'll start seeing, and I'm curious about others' perspectives, is companies being bought specifically for the talent, regardless of the value of the company. So, for example, you know, Mark is already rich, so that's not a problem for him. But, you know, arguably someone could say, come along and say, hey, look, I want to give you $10 billion for all this simply so you come work for me and make my company better.
Google does that today.
You know, I think that's a very dangerous path to go down, because if you've worked with these sort of really interesting, really bright guys, they're often more interested in the problem than in the check. And so the check holds their attention for, you know, about 5 minutes. And as soon as the acquisition is done and the money's in the bank, their attention starts to wander. And I think you're misleading yourself if you think you can buy talent by just buying the company that the talent works for. They're going to stick around only as long as the problems are interesting, the management is good, they feel like they're focusing on the problems that they want. I think the challenge that we have in in acquiring talent is articulating a problem that's interesting enough. And you know, one of the things that's very true about Linux is that it's a well understood problem. So that makes it fundamentally a little bit less interesting to people who are just looking for, you know, what's the latest and greatest stuff. It is a very interesting problem. There's lots of really interesting stuff to be done in Linux, but you have to be particularly interested in that and not just sort of cruising for the latest thing. Another really great example of this is VMware. You know, the VMware guys were working at a company whose stock was going nowhere because it was part of EMC, and yet they were still able to attract some extraordinary talent because they had a particular culture and they were focusing on some really interesting problems, and you couldn't work on those problems anywhere else to the same extent as you could at VMware. And so, you know, they defended that talent base against Google very efficiently. And obviously now they also have, you know, some hot stock to throw at the problem. But they articulated a really, really interesting problem, did it very well, and attracted a lot of talent as a result.
What about guys like Sun and Novell and even Red Hat at this point, who seem to be having a bit of a talent shift, if you will? You don't think that strategy will... I mean, I don't know what, I don't know that it's a good answer, but I think they'll do it.
Yeah, I'm not sure why you would go and work for Sun now. It's, you know, their market cap is less than that of VMware. I think they have done extraordinary things, but it's...
You think the game is over?
I think that is something that they're going to have to think about very carefully. I think they're going to struggle to attract really, really great people. Having said that, they've done, you know, there's some great young guys who are super talented who are doing great things at Sun, so maybe they can lead a turnaround in that regard.
I think they've always been a spot where kind of engineering-minded people wanted to go, but like you say, I mean, there's a lot of options now, whether it's Google or VMware or all these open-source companies.
Yeah. What are you guys sort of antennae telling you about Google in terms of people's desire to go and work there? Because it was kind of a vacuum cleaner sucking up talent, but perhaps it isn't. Perhaps it's coming to the end of that phase.
I think it's not as easy of a place to work as it once was. I actually, one of my friends from college was one of the first engineers to quit Google. And it was like a legendary thing still that he, you know, he had quit, you know, after less than a year, and he didn't. He hated it, didn't even care about his options or anything else. So I think it depends on what your job is and what you do. But the word on the street is that at this point, if you get hired there, you're sitting in a hallway and you don't even know who your boss is. So I think it really depends on what role you get and sort of the different kind of – I don't know, man. I got to think the management over there, the management challenge over there has to be enormous.
Wow, yeah.
What's the
How do you – Yeah, how do you deal with your first real crisis in the company when suddenly, you know, you have to start deciding who stays and who goes? In a world where you hired people sort of on the promise that they can pretty much work on whatever they want to work on,
I think that that's a falsehood at this point. Ashley knows more about this, but I think that that's a bunch of crap. I don't know any, all the guys that I know who still work there don't have that 20% time and never had it. There's like an elite group. It's like the guys that, the guys who were at Bell Labs, when I worked at Bell Labs, like Rob Pike and all those guys, are now at Google. I think they get to do whatever they want, but I think all the monkeys that come out of college, I think they're doing a bunch of grunt work.
The funny thing is, too, what you guys were talking about on the management, I know a couple people have remarked to me, I mean, they have no one that shepherds their projects, but, I mean, they all tell me that this is, it's like a commune where, you know, the great things still rise to the top on their own, and like Mark said, I just wonder, I feel like you can go along that way fine as long as AdWords is pulling in all this money and there's no pressure on you to do other things, really, but, at some point, somebody's got to be held responsible.
Interesting. They haven't hit a real crisis. They haven't had, I mean, same argument could be made for Facebook. They haven't had anything really bad happen yet. They haven't had a major security breach or anything else like that. But you got to wonder what's going to happen over there, too, although they're not hiring at the pace. But, you know, as a sort of a sideline to this is one of the things, and I hate to give Alfresco any credit, but one of the smart things that they did is they hired actual executives, whether or not you liked that these guys, you know, came from stupid companies or whatever else, they knew how to grow a business and they know how to manage. And you can see the difference, I think, especially in a startup, of when you have some experienced management versus kind of going for the commune, hippie, it's all good, whatever, when money doesn't matter. Because sooner or later, money does matter. I think that's the ultimate point, right?
I've got another question for you guys, this esteemed panel of inquisitors. How long do you think ad-supported services and content are going to fly in a world where things like Adblock become prevalent?
You're trying to put the Register out of business.
What's that?
Well, we're trying to put the Register out of business.
No, that's not my intent. We just have to evolve, you know, with the rest of us.
We just discovered on the last call, or at least I did, Adblock, and I have been extremely happy ever since, because I don't see any more ads. What needs to be done is somebody needs to make a business out of
blocking ads and then selling them again, right?
I think Matt's breaking up a little.
Matt's breaking up. Well, you know, it's interesting, I think, because if you do make Google perfect AdWords, so like we use AdWords, and the first time I finally read like the keyword tracking kind of thing, I found that there was 36,000 sites that had no relation to my product that they were targeting us on. So I cut my spend by like 75%.
Well, if you're part of that content network on the Google AdWords, it's just it's insane how much it's a total scam. They enrolled me in that on for my little dinky website. I went from paying 20 cents a month to like $50 a month. And it was just because they were serving to this content network, like tens of thousands of ads. I have no idea where they were going.
I think the even stupider, if that stupider word, even more stupid, are the guys.
Stupider is a word for people who would use it, yeah.
Are the guys who are building businesses that only work on Facebook. What pot-headed, dream did you have where you're going to build something on top of a platform that you have no control over, no ownership of, and could care less about you?
Wait, I thought that's what Microsoft was just trying to do.
They are.
Salesforce.com.
Same thing. I went to the Salesforce. I went to Dreamforce, and I walked away extremely depressed for the 150 companies that were on display there. So you look at them, you can see every one of them going out of business because unless you get assimilated into that Borg of Salesforce, you have, you know, your chance for success or getting beyond, for the sake of argument, $10 million are minimal. There'll be one or two of them, and then they'll never get past that.
So what, you are kind of their free R&D department. Anything that you do that is a huge success will get assimilated, either if you're lucky through an acquisition or if you're unlucky just through cloning.
No, and, Salesforce buys the second one. They buy the guy who almost do it, but they don't buy the one that's the market leader, and the market leader goes out. But it's interesting because, you know, one of the interesting things, and this is probably a different talk, is when you look at open source and I think, you know, build systems and modularity, all this stuff has become very clear, and it's something that, you know, software development is used to. And then when you look at on-demand and SaaS in general, I mean, you start getting involved in things like database schemas very early on and, you know, user management and all this other kind of stuff. There's no sort of commonality amongst the way these guys do this. Yeah, not even close. And I think that that's an enormous challenge when you try to figure out what's going to happen next for these companies.
Can we return to Mark's original question just while we still have him? I mean, what would you guys do for if you're the Register and there's this ad blocking stuff? Because I heard Jonathan Schwartz yesterday giving a speech at Stanford where he said pretty much the same thing, that you know, any of these kind of online magazines and everything, we're going to face such a big challenge moving forward. I mean, what possibly is the other revenue model?
I think people will pay for quality content, and I think you'll always be able to get advertisements for something. I think it's just that the mass market advertising thing will probably go away. But, it, you know, the Register, as an example, I think is it's a bit of a niche, not entirely, right? But, you know, it's IT, and it's got a certain context to it. So there's people out there who are going to be interested in it, and maybe you have a smaller amount of advertising, but maybe it's worth more dollars.
So just imagine Microsoft IE8 comes out and there's a control panel option in there which says that you can choose to have no ads, or you can choose to have personalized ads, or you can choose to have, you know, raw ads or something.
Yeah,
most
hell.
People would choose no ads. Some people would choose personalized ads, and of course they will then be getting ads out of Microsoft's ad network. And then, you know, the unattractive sounding option will then go with whatever the poor site owner thought he was selling. So it just seems to me that ad-supported service and content is hugely vulnerable.
You guys got to give me a model to work with here.
Well, so let's think about it. Well, people would potentially pay for the podcast to sponsor the podcast, as an example.
Well, and yeah, actually, people are inquiring about
maybe
that.
Actually, the answer is what they're doing in the music industry. You've got to go on tour. You've got to go.
Yeah.
I would pay to meet you in person. I would pay to meet. I don't care what you write. It's all crap. Stick an ad next to it. I'll block it. But if I can meet you in person.
So you're saying like
I hate meeting people in person. They always say, man, I want to
buy. I want to buy the Acid Against t-shirt.
So I could drink beer for a living, essentially.
You can become.
It's not going to work for Matt.
No. I could just go down to the pub and.
Well, so maybe it's, you know, by that point your book will be out. You'll be famous. Well, you'll be like Nick Carr. It won't matter, dude. You'll get a fellowship at Harvard. You're all set.
All right.
The rest of us will be slogging away.
The vote of confidence. Thank you.
This all sounds very good, guys. I like the way you think. Well, Mark.
All right, guys. This was fun. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for your time. And David, Matt, thanks as always.